also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, a while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in thousands. A tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abelloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia.
A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Erromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is
is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. The Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
Those are patients.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital, Moscow, to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, It becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the Pris docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter will remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and the Pris will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting Pris will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multi-purpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the sixth spacewalk in 2021 in support of the space station assembly, maintenance, and upgrades.
Albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf, named Han Yisa, was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yisa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter especially built for elephants northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburned. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild.
IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new survey of more than 600 middle and high school students across four American states finds that 41% feel very unsafe or unsafe when they see police officers at their public schools. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, More Than Two-Thirds of American Students Want Police Out of Schools. Stay tuned for the details, please. A new study of more than 600 middle and high school students across four American states finds that 41% feel very unsafe or unsafe when they see police officers at their public schools. One-third said they feel targeted by police based on an aspect of their identity, such as race, primary language, sexual orientation, or gender identity. And students reported bullying and sexual harassment by police at multiple public schools. When asked what does make them feel safe at school, students overwhelmingly said teachers and friends, and more than two-thirds said police should be removed from school altogether. Only 16% of students said police make them feel safe. Courtney Blake, a ninth grader in New York City and youth leader with the Urban Youth Collaborative, which conducted the survey locally, said the findings make her feel disgusted and angry at the system. These are the experiences of young children and teenagers across the country, yet it feels personal because they reflect how I feel, Blake said in a statement. At school, police don't make me feel safe. Instead, they make me feel like I did something wrong. The in-depth survey of recent and current students of public schools in Oregon, New York, Nevada, and New Jersey reveals broad support for the student-led movement to remove police from schools and increase funding for teachers, student programming, and mental health supports. Activists are relatedly fighting to end the school-to-prison pipeline, which refers to policies and practices that isolate students and color immigrants and students with disabilities from supportive learning environments and instead funnels them toward the criminal legal system. This puts the students at risk of being incarcerated or, in the case of undocumented students, deported or separated from family members. Redirecting funding from police departments to education and social programs is also a long-standing goal of the movement for Black Lives that has inspired nationwide protests against the over-policing of communities of color. Of the students surveyed who report seeing cops at school, 50% said they have seen police interrupt learning to remove students from the classroom. And 1 in 5 reported that the cops verbally harass or make fun of students. Alarmingly, students reported sexual harassment by police in 3 of the 4 local areas surveyed. And more than a quarter said they have seen students arrested at school. Of the students who reported a police presence at school, 32% said they saw police at school on a daily basis, and 95% said they see cops at least once a month. Students also reported frequent interactions with security guards. 30% of black students said they interact with security guards on a daily basis. Metal detectors are more common at majority black and brown schools, and students of color were more likely to be searched and have belongings taken by police or security guards than white students. In the Las Vegas School District of Clark County, more than a quarter of students reported that they or someone they know has been pepper sprayed by police at school. School police in the district made headlines after using pepper spray in response to fights between students in recent years, with thousands of students and faculty pepper sprayed in one high-profile incident. Schoolyard fights can be used to justify the presence of police in schools, but when asked what they would like to see more of in school, students overwhelmingly chose additional resources and support for students and teachers over police and security. For example, 78% said they would like to see better mental health support and youth-led programs dedicated to increasing access to college, while only 8% said they would like more police. The survey was conducted by students and community groups that support the movement to remove police from schools and focused largely on diverse public schools located in urban and suburban areas. Schools where at least 75% of students are black are more likely to have police officers and on-site security than schools where a majority of students are white, according to federal civil rights data. Many students know that black and indigenous adults and teens, for example, are more likely to be targeted, brutalized, and even killed by police outside of a school. Nationally, reams of data show that students of color and students with disabilities are disproportionately referred to police or arrested while at a school, and black students are more than twice as likely as white students to be disciplined by cops. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, students with disabilities are more than 3 times as likely to be sent or arrested by the police, a disparity that is much wider in some states. A study conducted in New Orleans during the 2018 to 2019 school year found that only 40% of black students said they felt safer around police at school, compared to 69% of white students. What did we do to deserve police in our schools? Blake said. We deserve support and resources, not police. Racial justice experts say students of color have always been systematically excluded from learning and marginalized at schools and universities, reflecting the deeply entrenched racism and white supremacy in education going back decades. Civil civil rights groups argue that students with disabilities, as well as Black, Indigenous, and other students of color, often have to attend public schools with fewer resources, accommodations for students with disabilities, and supports for staff, making teachers more likely to call on police to deal with behavioral problems. The survey also found that 56% of students who say their school is majority Black report going through metal detectors on a daily basis, which can make a school feel more like a jail. Among the students who have metal detectors in their schools, 34% of Black students report that their belongings have been confiscated, compared to 14% of white students. Black and Latino students were also more likely to have been asked to remove their shoes to be searched than white students.
As the war in Yemen is raging on, the Saudi-led coalition is getting to the end of its tether in the face of Yemeni resistance groups, above all the Ansarullah movement. The Saudis have now to meet their nemesis at home in what many expect to be the final stages of the bloody war, not least because the Saudis and their accomplices have been enervated in a war of attrition they kindled 6 years ago. Not surprisingly, as one of their last-ditch attempts to save face, the Saudis are now busy issuing denials of heavy defeats on the front lines, and at the same time fabricating feats for their crestfallen forces. Recently, the Yemeni army and the fighters from the popular committees released new videos of a major operation carried out on May 28th against the Saudi kingdom's forces and mercenaries.
The operation was quite exceptional because it was extremely well fought. It is on the territory and high ground that the Saudis were in control of, and the large number of Saudi and Sudanese and other Yemeni who support the Saudis and are considered as a mercenary, the large number and the high equipment quality that they had did not prevent Ansarullah from occupying it.
The Yemeni's Al-Masira television channel reported that in the operation, sensitive targets were hit across the three strategic mountainous areas of Jabal Abdud, Al-Rami, and Jafan in the southern Saudi region of Jizan. According to the report, more than 80 mercenaries were killed, and at least 32 armored vehicles were damaged. The Yemeni forces reportedly managed to take full control of dozens of sites in the Saudi region after the mercenaries, who included Sudanese forces, were pushed back. Yemeni forces managed to seize control of at least 40 sites in the mountainous region, after which the Saudi Air Force sent warplanes that inflicted damage on their own military equipment. Given the recent achievements in southwestern Saudi Arabia, Yemen's Supreme Political Council has announced that the Yemeni side is prepared to exchange the bodies of those killed during the operations with Saudi Arabia. The Yemenis have stepped up their retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia in recent months, saying they will continue unabated as long as Riyadh carries on with its bombardment and blockade.
We saw the number of the Houthis was inferior to the number of the people, the Saudis and the Sudanese and the other occupying the position. And that also another lesson to learn from the military tactic point of view. And we saw that the light infantry can really defeat highly equipped forces when they're not motivated, they are not the owner of the ground, and they are there because they've been told that they want to occupy a foreign territory. However, we saw from Ansarullah Houthis that they are the owner of the ground, and this is what permit them to think less about the sacrifices they need to undergo in order to recover their own territory and liberate it from the Saudi occupation.
Meanwhile, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, recently announced that the army troops and allied fighters from popular committees have hit sensitive targets in King Khalid Air Base in the Saudi city of Khamis Mushayk, some 884 kilometers south of the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The overnight attack was carried out by two of the country's domestically developed Qassem-2K, Stryker-2K combat drones. Earlier this year, Yemen's Air Force carried out a number of operations against sensitive and important sites in Saudi Arabia, including Abha International Airport.
This is was very clear that there is an axis of the resistance that is coordinating its knowledge at passing on information and sharing experiences. The attack that Ansarullah carried out reminded me of the same attacks Hezbollah used to carry out against the Israeli occupation of the south of Lebanon in the 90s. However, now today, with modern equipment, with anti-tank missiles, and with more advanced knowledge on how you occupy a high ground, particularly from the war that Hezbollah was engaged in Syria to liberate the Syrian territory from the Takfiri extremists. And we saw this happening on the Syrian-Lebanese borders. We saw this happening in the Kalamun area in Syria. And we saw exactly the more or less the same reproduction in Jizan and on high ground. Therefore, the simple conclusion is there is a shared experience among the axis of the resistance, and Ansarullah are part of this axis, and they are learning from those members who have been through the same experience, and they're implementing it, and it resulted successfully.
In one of its latest articles, Foreign Policy has analyzed the situation in Yemen, saying Yemen's popular Ansarullah movement won the U.S.-sponsored war waged by Saudi Arabia, stressing that the losers are now in no position to dictate terms to the victors. It said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman launched the offensive on the assumption that it would bring an easy victory. Instead, it became a public relations debacle. Saudi Arabia not only publicly brutalized a desperate and impoverished population, but also proved incapable of defeating a ragtag group of rebels, despite billions of dollars of U.S. military hardware. The Saudis' recent willingness to negotiate a ceasefire reflects their weakened position.
The Saudis, they thought they're coming to a ground, to a territory, that is on a promenade, and they will finish the war in a few weeks. This is what Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said at the beginning, and that was 6 years ago. And we understand today that this war is exhausting the Saudis' resources, and it's giving no results at the exception of destroying Yemen and creating the largest humanitarian crisis in the poorest country of the Middle East. However, this Saudi attempt to continue and not to back off in their failed attempt to occupy Yemen, it is something that the Saudis, I think, are thinking about carefully, and because the results are very slim, or no result at all.
In reaction, the Saudis are claiming that all the attacks and defeats are fabricated by the Ansarullah movement, a statement that does not hold much water, given all those footage and documents released by the Yemeni side. Through downplaying the achievements of the Yemeni side, the Saudis are seeking to salvage their reputation. After all, who would take seriously a kingdom which cannot win a war against the poorest forces of Yemen? In spite of having a coalition on its side, a bunch of world powers in its camp, and an arsenal worth billions of dollars at its disposal. Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Snake bites annually cost India's citizens the equivalent of 3 million years of health and productivity. That figure, reported at a meeting last month, puts the spotlight on survivors of the bites who are left with disabling conditions such as amputation, kidney disease, and severe scarring. Stay with with us for an article in this regard penned by Kerry Arnold, a commentator and writer, under the heading "Snake Bite Steals Millions of Years of Quality Life in India." The analysis provides the first estimation of the toll of snake bites on survivors in India. It also confirms an earlier calculation showing that over half of the world's snake bite deaths occur in the country, demonstrating the need for greater investment in preventive measures. Snake bite is just still really not very well studied or understood at the same level as a lot of these other tropical diseases, says Nick Roberts, who was part of the team at Seattle-based University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, that calculated the latest figures. The World Health Organization, WHO, designated poisoning by snake bite a neglected tropical disease in 2017, and last year launched a global initiative to halve the number of deaths and disabilities it causes by 2030. The initiative highlights the need for better data, says Prabhat Jha, director of the Center for Global Health Research in Toronto, Canada. If the goal is to reduce a snake bite death by half, then you need to know where the problems are. Because many people who are bitten by snakes never enter hospitals or healthcare centers, they're not formally recorded, and researchers frequently underestimate the impact of the bites across the globe. Snake bite also doesn't receive a lot of attention because it is a disease affecting mainly impoverished farmers and their families in rural areas. Snake bite disease takes a huge toll on India, partly because the subcontinent is home to so many different types of snakes. 60 of the country's nearly 300 species are highly venomous, explains Priyanka Kadam, president and founder of the Snake Bite Healing and Education Society, an organization in Mumbai. It can also be impossible for those bitten in remote parts of the country to get treatment because the nearest health clinic might be several hours away, she says. Even then, clinics don't always have anti-venom on hand, and if they do, it might not have been stored properly or be of good quality. So few of those poisoned by snake bites are treated in hospital, concrete data on the impact of the bites has been challenging to obtain. Global estimates of a snake bite death have ranged from 50,000 to 125,000. In India alone, they have varied from 11,000 to 50,000. In 2011, Jha and his colleagues tried to nail down more accurate estimates for snake bite deaths in India. He runs the Million Death Study, an effort to clarify causes of death in the country using verbal reports from family and physicians. On the basis of these reports, Jha calculated that 45,900 snake bite deaths occur each year in India, sparing officials to revise worldwide figures. Today, the WHO gives a range of 81,000 to 138,000 annual snake bite deaths globally. The IHME analysis provides the first quantitative information on the long-term effects for people who survive snake bites. Such estimates are important, says Kadam, because they can provide insight into healthcare costs and other societal burdens. The analysis also broadly supports Jha's estimation of the number of snake bite deaths, finding that about 52,000 people died of a snake bite in India last year. It used a different data source from Jha, however, the 2019 Global Burden of Disease, GBD study. This data set also used by the WHO provides worldwide estimates on illness and death for 369 diseases and injuries using official vital statistics and verbal autopsy reports, allowing scientists to compare the burden of a snake bite between countries. Jahal, however, is critical of the accuracy of the latest analysis, contending that the GBD study uses complex and non-transparent models to determine how many people died and how. IHME has also caught heat recently for the transparency of its COVID-19 models, although those efforts remain separate from the snakebite work. Roberts acknowledges that the GBD study isn't perfect, but said that our modeled estimates attempt to use high-quality data, correct possible biases in the data, and create accurate estimates at scale. No matter what estimates are used, says Roberts, the WHO's goal to halve snakebite deaths and disabilities by 2030 is ambitious. We are not on track to meet it, he adds, given that snakebite deaths in India have declined only slightly, if at all, over the past decade. Kadam, whose organization works with scientists and policymakers to reduce the impact of a snake bite in India, says the data show an urgent need for a focused change at the policy level and access to basic health care, particularly in rural areas where many people live.
World with reporters.
As EU leaders continue to try and grapple with COVID-19, hundreds of visitor hotspots across the bloc are more like ghost towns due to ongoing travel restrictions. The European Parliament has approved the EU Digital Travel Certificate. It is supposed to be operational by the 1st of July. Seven EU nations are already using it, but some countries say they won't until the middle of July.
The patchwork is still here, the spaghetti of rules and regulations. Dear national governments, it is in your hands to make sure that people can travel freely.
The new travel cert will show if someone has been vaccinated, recovered from COVID-19, or has had a negative test. A large cohort of EU lawmakers are furious that tests will not be free. They claim it is a mechanism to effectively force citizens to get vaccinated. People struggling financially who don't want or don't have access to the jab will not be able to travel, legislators point out. Tests could also be very costly for cross-border workers. This is all very discriminatory, legislators say. Free movement of people within the 27-nation EU is supposed to be a fundamental right. The lack of travel is having a devastating economic impact.
Uncertainties remain, as the near-term economic outlook continues to depend on the course of the pandemic and how the economy responds after reopening.
Official data shows the youth unemployment rate in the EU is double that of the general population, and that might be an underestimation.
I think it's definitely hard, especially if you start working after studying. I had a lot of friends, even with a good diploma, that had some problems in finding a job, like my brother, for example.
The job market is not very high, actually, so yeah, I mean, COVID, of course, increases this situation, but we are scared anyway.
The EU travel certificate is being hailed as a tool to jumpstart the bloc's economy, but many lawmakers have data protection concerns.
This crisis is being misused in order to get unpopular things through the back door.
These doors should remain shut. The certificate should in no way be used to assert control.
Amid growing fears over people's jobs, the European Central Bank has again appealed to EU leaders not to dither over the deployment of COVID-19 recovery funding. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have shot dead some Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid in the city of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin to carry out an arrest operation, according to the Israeli military. Outside the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority's military intelligence, a shootout erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian security forces. During the operation, Israeli forces killed Jamil Al-Amouri, a member of the Jihad movement and a former prisoner, and also arrested another operative whom Israel claims it was looking for both.
What happened in Jenin is a new crime. Israel has got crazy after facing resistance by the Palestinians in Al-Quds, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Now it's seeking to show its strength by more killings. It thinks that these killings would prevent the Palestinians from continuing their struggle, but the Palestinians have shown that they won't give in to pressure.
Palestinian factions from across the political spectrum called a general strike in the city to mark the deaths of those killed. Thousands of mourners turned out on the streets in Jenin City to take part in the funeral's procession of the security officers. A third funeral has not been held, as the Israeli forces had arrested the third man before he succumbed to his injuries.
There are orders from the Israeli authorities to accelerate the situation. Netanyahu doesn't want to leave office. He doesn't want to be imprisoned. That's why he wants to make an escalation. But Israel must know that it would pay a high price for its crimes.
The Palestinian presidency has meanwhile condemned the Israeli operation in Jenin, with spokesman Nabil Aburdena holding the Israeli regime responsible for this escalation and its consequences.
Israeli forces have not yet handed over the body of the third Palestinian killed during Jenin raid, Jamil Al-Amouri, a former prisoner and member of the Jihad movement. And now Tel Aviv withholds the bodies of 79 Palestinians in its mortuaries, claiming they were killed for operations against Israeli forces. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The June 18th presidential vote draws to a close in Iran, and candidates are on a tight schedule, trying to make the best of the remaining time to attract more public support. In addition to televised campaigns, candidates now visit universities and other key places to increase their popularity among people from different walks of life.
When I make a promise, I'll give you a clear roadmap that shows every step of my plan. For example, if I promise to solve the issue of housing, I will give you the exact timeline of the procedure and the number of houses that I will build for the people who don't have a house.
We try to analyze the current state of affairs in Iran and create plans that are based on real circumstances of our society. We concluded that we could make tangible changes based on our plans.
All of the seven contenders have rich executive backgrounds, from sitting atop the judicial branch to running the Central Bank of Iran. But perhaps their past plays the least part in winning the race, since it's what they plan for the future that matters to voters.
I have a special plans regarding the exchange market. I believe that the capital market plays a significant role in financing the countries in this race.
If I took office, I would eliminate the coronavirus once and for all within less than 6 months. I also have comprehensive health policies that would reduce the cost significantly for patients.
We do have plans, but we cannot break them down to their details during a limited time of campaigns. God willing, if I'm elected president, I will operate those plans.
Aside from electoral campaigns, which are mostly held in the form of televised addresses, the candidates face off in live debates. So far, the seven runners have attended two televised debates. The first was themed with economy, and the second centered on social affairs. The third and final showdown is slated for June 12th.
Unlike previous rounds where the elections were more of a clash of the parties, this time it's a race of plans. Plans that can ensure a better economy and a brighter future for Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The blame Iran game has
has been going on for years, but most times it's a ploy used in the Middle East. This time, however, British right-wing newspapers are linking the Islamic Republic to the independence push in Scotland and Wales.
Ever since, the very real threat of a potential UK breakup reached the forefront of British politics, stories have begun emerging claiming that Iran-linked social media accounts are spreading fake news online, or that Tehran is somehow building working relations with several anti-Westminster political parties. They've all been doing the rounds. However, are these stories true, and where do they come from?
Political experts in Scotland are far from convinced.
The idea is preposterous. This is desperation. This is a desperate attempt to push back against the momentum that built up in support of Scottish independence. And the ghouls of the British establishment are looking for external bogeymen and scapegoats, when they really should be looking in the mirror to understand why Scottish independence has now gained the firm support of the majority of people living in Scotland. And if anything, it's Britain that interferes in Iranian politics, interferes in the politics of countless countries across the world due to its malign role.
The latest story released by The Telegraph on June the 6th bases its report on work done by UK-based think tank the Henry Jackson Society, whose reputation has been in question many times before.
Henry Jackson Society is well known for its extreme views, extreme right views, extremely pro-Zionist, with bells on, and Islamophobe by its nature. As a matter of fact, is being sort of highlighted by just about every Muslim organization or every other sort of human rights organization as something which was set up to bring extreme right-wing policies into British politics.
Ironically, for British media, the UK's long-standing reputation of meddling in other countries' affairs seems to undermine their attempts to derail the independence train, which has clearly left the station. Robert Carter, London.
Roughly 1 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Korea from the United States earlier this week. More Americans have been vaccinated than people in any other country, and the U.S. is now sharing, suggesting no strings are attached, with exceptions and flexibility.
The United States is not asking anything of any country to whom we're giving doses. We're not seeking to extract concessions. We're not extorting. Korea's situation is unique, as the president said when President Moon visited. The animating purpose behind that is actually about the protection of American forces and the forces who serve alongside American forces, the Korean troops who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us in that country.
The World Health Organization and infectious disease experts have criticized wealthy countries for hoarding vaccines, vaccine nationalism, even calling it vaccine apartheid. Experts say the U.S. gift to South Korea had various motives. The U.S. has restricted the use of its vaccine supply for South Korea to Korean soldiers that work alongside the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in the country.
U.S. efforts to contain China accelerated back in 2007 with the creation of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue involving Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. South Korea has been reluctant to join the grouping as it does not want to offend its main trading partner, China, which has condemned the Quad for targeting Beijing.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in secured the vaccines during a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in late May, as Seoul struggles to balance its alliance with the United States and growing trade with China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, says it's still not clear whether the U.S. is ready to abandon what he calls an addiction to imposing sanctions on Iran. Addressing the IAEA's Board of Governors, Gharibabadi said Iran is in favor of continuing negotiations aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, but that it would only go back to full compliance after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions.
The ball
is actually in the court of the United States. They have to take very difficult decisions,